what sorts of information. Injuries, first and foremost. Lombardi was obsessed with keeping news on the condition of his key players away from the press and the opposition, and he could do it rather successfully before the era of 24-hour radio sports shows and strict league requirements on reporting injuries. Not only did he pressure reporters not to write about certain injuries, but he also tried, when possible, to keep the news from them in the first place. Robert Strom, then an X-ray technician at St. Vincent Hospital on Van Buren Street, later related a story revealing the length to which Lombardi went in that regard. Strom once got a call from Dr. James Nellen, one of the two team physicians, after a home game. "Our X-ray department had a fire door in the back that you could get out, but it wasn't supposed to be an entrance," Strom recalled. Nellen called and said, "Bob, meet us at the back door in exactly 30 minutes. Be there." 30 minutes later, a car pulls up by the back door. Nellen, Vince Lombardi, and Bart Starr get out. Bart had an injured finger. Vince wanted to hide all his injuries from the media and the league. Nellen said to me, "This is not to be recorded. Every patient had to have a number in a file." "No number, Bob," he said. So I didn't record it in the book. I took the picture. They waited for it to be developed, and before anyone else saw it, Dr. Nellen took it. Lombardi came along to make sure none of the media saw it. It was a cloak-and-dagger thing. When they left, Nellen said, "If anyone calls and asks, 'Any Packers here?' you know what the answer is." Journalists sometimes mistakenly assumed that Lombardi was oblivious, so preoccupied with coaching that he had no idea who they were or what they wrote. In fact, he read almost everything and paid more attention to them than he let on. With the flinty eyes of a censor, he edited every press release and game program that his publicity department published. He combed the papers looking for stories that might distract his players from the mission of winning the next game. He studied the power and influence of various sports writers. When he brought his West Point ally, Aki Kruger, to Wisconsin to run the Milwaukee ticket office, he gave him one bit of advice. "The only man you've got to get along with in Milwaukee is Ollie Kukul." Kruger made a point of befriending Kukul, the lead columnist of the Milwaukee Journal. Bud Lee of the Sentinel grew close to Kruger, too, but never felt the same about Lombardi. "Honest to God, I wanted to get along with the guy," Lee said later. "It was a great opportunity. He was a great leader, but I never felt at ease with him." Once, after having a few drinks at the 5 o'clock club on the road and screwing up his nerve, Lee confronted Lombardi, almost. "I'll take this stuff, but only one thing," Lee said. "What's that?" Lombardi asked. "Don't lose." "Mister," said Lombardi, "I don't intend to." He very nearly kept his word in 1962. The Packers were so talented and prepared in Lombardi's fourth year that they barely needed the multiple skills of their left halfback. Paul Hornung was out of the service. "Hornung arrives in Packers camp," shouted the headline in the Chicago Tribune when he joined his teammates on July 24th to prepare for the college All-Star game, a reflection of how big he'd become. The Golden Boy returned to the Packers with a new glow, having snubbed a $250,000 offer to switch leagues and play for the New York Jets of the American Football League. "Players were worth more than they were getting," Hornung said. "But $250,000? Nobody is worth that much." Besides, leaving the Packers for the Jets would be like leaving the New York Yankees for the Louisville Colonels. Hornung stayed, but in the fifth game he was slowed by a knee injury that sidelined him for several games and forced him to relinquish his kicking duties for the rest of the year. Tom Moore, Elijah Pitts, and the rookie, Earl Groh, filled in nicely when needed in the backfield, and Jerry Kramer, the strapping offensive guard, took over the place kicking, booting 38 extra points and 9 field goals in 11 attempts. Bart Starr, also ailing, had an average year, throwing nearly as many interceptions, 9, as touchdown passes, 12. Most of the offensive load was carried by Jim Taylor, who'd been improving every season and now had the best year of his career, pounding for 1,474 yards and 19 touchdowns, surpassing the totals that year of the immortal Jim Brown. The Packers amassed more than 30 points 8 times that season, outscoring their opponents by a total of 415 to 148 and compiling the highest point spread of the post-war era, 19.1 points more than their opponents per game. It was their defense that made them nearly invincible. Ray Nitschke had tamed his self-destructive off-the-field behavior and channeled his aggression into playing a ferocious middle linebacker on Sunday afternoons. He'd always seemed like an angry man, especially when he'd drunk too much, when even his teammates were afraid of him. Nitschke had grown up virtually parentless on the west side of Chicago. His father had died when Ray was 3, his mother when he was 13. He lived with an older brother and roamed the streets, feeling that the world had been unfair to him and that he wanted to even the score. "I took it out on everybody else," he said later. "A day didn't go by that I didn't belt some other kid in the neighborhood. I was like that right through high school and college and even after I joined the Packers. Didn't take anything from anybody." Now he was married and calming down, 6 days a week at least. In front of Nitschke, Willie Davis and Henry Jordan were having dominating years on the front line. And behind him, Herb Adderley at cornerback and Willie Wood at safety lifted the play at those key positions to unparalleled heights, combining to stifle the opposition's passing game every week. Wood intercepted 9 passes and Adderley 7, returning them an average 18.8 yards. "We were a great, great team in 1962, Wood said later. "We were well-oiled. We had talent every place. Every guy knew what he was supposed to be doing. We were veterans then. And I thought we were awesome." Bill Hines had circled the date back when he left training camp in early August. He would return to Wisconsin for the September 30th game against the Chicago Bears. It was the third game of the regular season. Green Bay by then had swept through 6 exhibition games and the opening 2 against Minnesota and St. Louis without a blemish. Chicago had started on the coast with wins over San Francisco and Los Angeles. Packers versus Bears seemed to offer everything Hines needed to lend character and depth to his progressive narrative. The longest-running rivalry in the league, Halas and Lombardi, Papa Bear, and the Pope. Caceres and Taylor, Bill George and Nitschke, Doug Atkins and Willie Davis, J.C. Caroline and Adderley. It sounded dramatic in theory, but it didn't turn out that way. Taylor scored 3 touchdowns, Starr, Ron Kramer, and Pitts 1 apiece, and Adderley returned an interception for another score. The Packers were nearly perfect, which was fine, but the game was utterly without suspense. A 49-0 shutout wouldn't do for Hines's purposes. Hines knew he had to stay for at least another week. The Detroit Lions were coming to Green Bay next. "I'm hoping they win this one, and it's a good game," Hines said later. "I can't stay there forever waiting for a game I can use." He got the game of a writer's dream, or at least the ending. The Packers are trailing 7-6 with less than 2 minutes remaining. The game has been draining, grudging, alternately brutal and sloppy. The same offense that humbled the Bears cannot cross the goal line, scoring only on Hornung field goals. The Lions have the ball near midfield. Terry Bledsoe of the Milwaukee Journal is on the Packers' sidelines, plotting in his head the lead to a story about the team's first loss. There's no way for the Packers to win, he's thinking. Detroit is in full control. And then Milt Plum, the Lions quarterback, decides to throw a pass down and out to the flanker. But the receiver slips. I see the ball pass his outstretched hands, and then I hear the thump sound it makes as it hits Herb Adderley's hands, and he's got it, Lombardi recalled later. He's got it, and he's racing right by me now down our sideline. Adderley glides all the way down to the Lions' 18. After two running plays, Lombardi calls for a field goal on third down, and Hornung boots the 3 points that win the game 9-7. The Lions leave the field in disarray. Big Alex Karras, the defensive tackle, throws his helmet in disgust in the direction of his errant quarterback, Plum. Lombardi chokes up in the dressing room as his troops chant, "Herb! Herb!" Bledsoe is amazed by what he's witnessed. He calls it an absolutely illogical result brought on by only one thing. I attribute it to Lombardi's will. And Hines has his book. He is a pro and knows how it works. Sometimes, he says, it just drops in like that. After a final day of wrap-up reporting, Hines bade farewell to Green Bay and returned home to Stamford to begin writing the Lombardi book. He spent several days organizing his notes, a process of remarkable precision and simplicity. All of his material was contained in 6 of his little 10-cent memo books. They were filled in pencil from top line to bottom, both sides of the paper, from the first page to the last, with legible and orderly notes. On the right margin of every page, he drew a bracket down from the top line of a specific subject to its last line, and on the outside of the line wrote in vertical letters a simple subject heading. When he finished this task for all 6 books, he created a master index, listing all the subjects and the notebooks in which they appeared. No computer of later generations could be more efficient than W.C. Hines and his 60 cents worth of indexed notes. The Packers and Hines worked on nearly parallel schedules through the rest of the season. They practiced at 9. He began writing at 9. They broke for lunch and worked into the afternoon. He did the same. They were led by Lombardi, so was he. In fact, for the purposes of the book, he had become Lombardi. In the end, after all, this was Lombardi's book, written in the first person. The first word on the first page would be I, meaning Lombardi. For the book to work, he had to capture how Lombardi thought, talked, and felt. Hines had the proper disposition for the task. He wasn't as obsessed or temperamental as his subject, but he got along with Lombardi and thought he understood the coach and appreciated his greatness despite the apparent flaws. The thing that hit me with Lombardi and that we agreed on right away is that if you're gifted, you have a moral responsibility to fulfill that gift as best you can. Hines reflected later. I always believed it. And Lombardi believed it all the way. The book would be straightforward narrative, not a philosophical treatise, yet driven by that single, overarching idea, the moral imperative of paying the price to be great. Hines wrote the book in his makeshift den, a bantam-sized office that he'd constructed off the TV room in a corner of his garage. A radiator warmed him as winter approached. The cement floors were softened by cork tiles, the walls by Philippine mahogany paneling. There was just enough room for a desk and chair and small daybed for naps. With his notebooks and index laid out before him, he rolled 2 sheets of yellow copy paper around the platen of his Remington portable and began tap-tapping away. He wrote every day from September through Thanksgiving without taking a day off. On Sundays, he paused to watch football on television and track the remarkable progress of the Packers. The wins kept coming after the close call against the Lions. Minnesota, San Francisco, Baltimore, Chicago, Philadelphia, 49-0, payback for the title defeat in 1960, and Baltimore again. Lombardi and his Packers had 10 wins and no losses, unbeaten and seemingly unbeatable. The astounding team in the heartland was luring more Eastern riders to Green Bay along the route of the Blue Goose. Herbert Warren Wind of the New Yorker blew into the Northland for stays in October and November, arriving the second time to witness the rematch with the Colts. Wind paid homage to football particulars, calling the Packers perhaps one of the authentically great teams of all time. But his true function seemed to be that of an anthropologist, relating the practices of an exotic Aboriginal tribe to the sophisticates of New York City. He described the airport limo driver who had blurted out, "Real great, real great," in response to one of Wynn's dry jokes. I mention this because it soon became evident that a second addiction of the people in Green Bay is the phrase "real great," which they use as frequently and with as many shades of intonation and meaning as the French do with "ça va." When Wynn arrived at the stadium an hour before the Colts game, he took note that several thousand people were already on hand. Milling around the food concessions and taking on frankfurters, bratwurst, and coffee as reserve fuel against the sharp cold air. With a food counter tucked under the stands at nearly every portal, City Stadium is as beautifully designed for eating as it is for football. The field itself, like that at the Yale Bowl, is sunk well below ground level. After watching the Packers defeat the Colts 17-13, aided by a 103-yard kickoff return by Adderley and two stirring goal line stands, Wynn signed off with this summation of Green Bay culture. According to our native folklore, Green Bay, all wrapped up in football, epitomizes the sort of Midwestern community that drives its gentler spirits out of town, to Chicago, to New York, to Paris, to any place where their alien talents have a chance to flower. It's hard to know about these things, but my own feeling is that Green Bay would be an excellent place for any boy or girl to grow up in. Of course, I wouldn't go so far as to recommend that a visitor launch into a long disquisition on the Coureur de Bois for the benefit of the gang at the Packer Palladium. But if he did, there would be no bother about it. The chances are that they would simply think he was running on about some new quarterback who'd just come up with the Montreal Alouettes. One can see the gang at the Palladium reading that line and muttering in various shades of intonation, "Real great, real great." Which is not what they would have been saying in the early afternoon of November 22nd during the Thanksgiving Day game against the Lions. Detroit had a defense as tenacious as Green Bay's, and on that day, a demonstrably better one. With Joe Schmidt and Wayne Walker battering away at linebacker, and Night Train Lane, Yale Larry, and Dick LeBeau closing off the passing lanes. The scariest Lions were in the middle. Rarely did two defensive tackles dominate the way Roger Brown and Alex Karras did for those few hours in chilly Detroit. Brown stood 6'5" and weighed 300 pounds, and he looked even larger as he tossed aside Packer blockers and lumbered into the backfield in pursuit of Bart Starr. The lasting image of the game is of number 15, disappearing into the turf as Brown smothered him in the end zone for a safety. Karras was 3 inches shorter and 50 pounds lighter than Brown, but played just as large, harassing Starr all day. Jim Ringo, Fuzzy Thurston, and Jerry Kramer seemed at a loss on how to stop the mad rush. Thurston joked later that it was during the first half of that game that he perfected the lookout block, a maneuver in which he would look over his shoulder and yell, "Look out, Bart!" Bill Austin, Green Bay's line coach, later acknowledged that he had a copy of Detroit's defensive game plan. A scout had slipped it to him before the game, but that it made no difference. "We deciphered as much as we could, but we couldn't understand some of the words, I guess," Austin said. Starr ended up being sacked 11 times. With the Lions leading 26-0 as the fourth quarter began, the Packers knew they were beaten. The players seemed ready to head back to Green Bay. This did not promise to be the most joyous turkey dinner at the Elks Club, but anything was better than getting knocked around for another 15 minutes. During an offensive huddle, the bloodied Starr asked his bruised receivers if any of them believed they could get open. One after another, these usually ball-grubbing athletes demurred, until Max McGee finally broke up his teammates by advising, "Bart, why don't you throw an incomplete pass and nobody'll get hurt?" With that single joke, it was as though all the weight of the afternoon was lifted, and the Packers regained a small measure of pride with two last-quarter touchdowns, making the final score a less humiliating 26-14. As he watched the Turkey Day debacle on television back in Connecticut, Bill Hines grew increasingly glum. He was a realist, but nonetheless had harbored some hope of a perfect season, the sort of year that would make Lombardi and his Packers even larger in the national imagination, and in so doing, help the sale of the book. Lombardi, however, was not as dismayed as his co-author. He was even seen laughing in the dressing room after the game as he told the press, "You didn't think we were going to win them all, did you?" It was the psychology of the moment that mattered to Lombardi. After chatting warmly with Frank Mott, an old Fordham teammate who lived in Detroit, he went around the locker room and quietly talked to his players. Fuzzy Thurston had lost his mother that week and was preoccupied. Lombardi said he understood. Starr seemed too hurried. Lombardi told him to maintain his normal patience. Then he gathered the team around him and said that the true challenge was now before them. "Let it be an example to all of us. The Green Bay Packers are no better than anyone else when they aren't ready, when they play as individuals and not as one. Our greatest glory is not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall." Everyone had been too confident, he said. His team, the press, but mostly himself. In the week before the game, he'd allowed a television crew inside squad meetings for a report on the making of an undefeated team. No more of that. Now the press would stop writing about how invincible his team was. And he could whip the players again, reminding them that football wasn't easy, that they had to pay the price. "I wouldn't go so far as to say he was in favor of losing that game," said Terry Bledsoe, "but he seemed delighted the next week because he could scare everybody about what they had to do. He was always figuring that we were trying to get him to say they were a great team. He didn't want his players to think that unless he told them." "The loss," said Willie Davis, the defensive end, "did more than remove the pressure. From that point on, we never again got shook by losing." And they returned to their winning ways. By late December, Hines had written 6 chapters. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. He waited until the season was over to write Sunday. Lombardi traveled to New York again for league meetings, and he and Hines met one morning at the Prentice Hall offices in Englewood Cliffs, where editor George Flynn set up a projector, and they watched the film of the first Lions game. Lombardi offered more thoughts on each play, and Hines asked questions and took notes. With details he gleaned from that film session, Hines returned to Stamford and continued pecking away in his cork-bottom room. He was Lombardi again. And one afternoon in February, before he packed up his Remington and took the children on a holiday to Washington, D.C., he typed the final few paragraphs as though he were inside the coach's head, driving home from City Stadium in Green Bay on the October evening after the Lions game. "I've got to make them believers, I'm thinking. And then the problem all week will be to get them up again, all of them, for next Sunday. After this, how will I ever get them up again for next Sunday? That's what I'm thinking now, turning off Oneida Avenue in the traffic. Then for the first time I feel the fatigue coming, the tiredness coming all over me." The book came out the following September. Hines had wanted to title it 6 Days and Sunday, but Red Smith vetoed that idea. With that title, it'll end up in the bookstores with the biblical tracts, Smith said. What phrase did Lombardi use that might capture his personality? How about, "Shut up, Marie"? George Flynn suggested Riley. But of course, Marie wouldn't shut up. As Hines realized better than most, the fact that she kept talking made the book possible. It was only fitting, in the end, that Marie came up with the title. She said she loved Vin's phrase describing his philosophy of offensive football. Perfect, the others realized, and here at last was the title for a book that became a sports classic, with 23 printings over the ensuing decades. They called it Run to Daylight. Chapter 18. The End of Something. Marie had traveled to nearly every road game since the end of their first year in Green Bay. She sat at her husband's side in the front row of the plane and bus, shopped on Saturday in whatever city they visited, attended the 5 o'clock club late that afternoon, accompanied Vin to Mass Sunday morning, and watched the game from a seat in the stands with Aki Kruger and his wife, who supplied her with coffee and cigarettes and warm blankets. She was an essential part of the team's winning dynamic. As contentious as her relationship with Vince could be, it was never more clear how much he needed her than when the Packers were on the road. Marie could take Lombardi and give it to Lombardi like no one else, serving as both release valve and governor for his temper. Once she skipped a game in Texas, and Lombardi turned so surly that the players beseeched her never to do that again. No problem. She truly enjoyed the traveling life, and any opportunity to leave her remote northern outpost. The touchier part was Vince's insistence that their daughter Susan come along. One variation of God, family, and the Green Bay Packers was that wherever God and the schedule took the Packers, the Lombardis followed as a family. In explaining her father's motives, Susan later concluded that he felt that his job wasn't going to entitle him to be at home at 5 o'clock every night like any normal father, so one way to keep the family together was to bring it along. Susan stayed home only for the West Coast swing at season's end, which would have taken her out of school for 2 weeks. The rest of the time, there was a seat reserved for her on the charter, and she hated it. You look back and say how lucky you are, but at the age I was then, a teenager, I was involved with my friends and I wanted to stay home, she said later. I never put away my suitcase from weekend to weekend. I packed clothes, washed them, put them back in. My father made me go. The entire family, including Vincent on break from college, boarded the flight 3 days after Christmas carrying the Packers to New York for the 1962 championship game, a rematch with the Giants. The Lombardis were national celebrities now. 1 week earlier, in the December 21st issue of Time, on page 60, there was a picture of Lombardi and family, near a paragraph extolling Vince's proud home life. He lives in a comfortable $35,000 home, whose den is filled with trophies won by daughter Susan, 15, an accomplished horsewoman, and son Vince, 20, a 195-pound fullback for Minnesota's College of St. Thomas. And there was Lombardi, with his oversized hands around both children, teeth shining. Marie to the side, her neck ringed with pearls, laughing at the joke. Susan staring straight at the camera. Vincent stiff at attention in sport coat and tie, hands clasped politely in front of him, head tilted up with eyes closed, as though humoring his father's public joviality. Why wouldn't the old man be happy? His team had finished the regular season 13-1. The photograph was part of a huge cover story on Lombardi and his team and his sport. His bespectacled face dominated the cover. A color portrait of the coach in lucky camel's hair coat and fedora, with two indistinct packers behind him in uniforms, winter capes and helmets with the simple G, and beyond them, 12 rows of anonymous fans in the city stadium stands. The identifying slash across the upper left corner promoted Time's trendy contention that professional football had reached a new place in American life. The sport of the 60s, it declared, correctly, 2 years into the decade. The story ran under a familiar headline, Vinny, Vidi, Vici. And it seemed that every word was aimed at constructing a new mythology with Lombardi at the center. He was called the world's greatest football coach. His Packers were labeled the current wonder team of football, a group of superstars romantically molded out of a gang of has-beens. And the game they played was defined in Tex Mall style as the ultimate modern spectator sport and best expression of athletic professionalism and specialization. Football, as the pros go at it, is a game of special brilliance, played by brilliant specialists. So precise is the teamwork that a single mistake by one man can destroy the handiwork of 10. So many are the complexities that connoisseurs argue endlessly in a mysterious lingo over slotbacks, stunters, and buttonhooks. Even the innocent are mesmerized. Action piles upon action, thrill upon guaranteed thrill, and all with such bewildering speed that at the end the fans are literally limp. No other sport offers so much to so many. Boxing's heroes are papier-mâché champions. Hockey is gang warfare. Basketball is for gamblers. And Australia is too far to travel to see a decent tennis match. Even baseball, the sports writer's national pastime, can be a slow-motion bore. The Time article was well-received not only in Wisconsin, but also at the league office in New York, where Pete Rozelle, the aggressive commissioner, had been striving for 3 seasons to make the NFL anything but a bore. He couldn't have created a more effective cover himself. As a former publicity man in Los Angeles, he'd paid special attention to creating the right buzz and took notice at league meetings whenever magazines focused on the pro game. Life, Look, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Time had all done big spreads that year. The word was out among advertising agencies, publishers, and corporate executives that pro football was hot. One of Rozelle's missions was to make the NFL outrageously rich, and he'd taken a crucial step toward that goal, convincing the owners to adopt his Unity of Purpose plan on television rights by signing a single network contract for 1962. The plan strengthened the league all round, according to the commissioner, giving it more bargaining leverage with networks and more clout with blue-chip oil, beer, and cigarette advertisers, while also distributing revenues evenly to the benefit of small-market clubs. Lombardi and his Packers perhaps benefited most of all, as the joint venture meant that they earned as much from television as the New York Giants, where previously they were earning less than half as much. By the end of the 1962 season, it was apparent that pro football and television were made for one another. Baseball might be the national pastime, but its wide field, slow pace, and long summer season worked against it on the tube, whereas pro football was a weekend sport with fewer than 20 games a year, most of them played in fall and winter when more people were indoors. The game also seemed to benefit more from television technology. The zoom lens, slow motion, isolated cameras, and later instant replay, all made it easier for the average fan to pick up nuances of the action that were hard to see from a seat in the stands. Baseball was a long novel whose story grew in complexity and richness over the course of months. Pro football offered a discreet live drama every week, with an uncertain ending. The sport had a new cliché, that any team could win on any given Sunday, and the Lions had proved it once again on Thanksgiving Day with their defeat of the otherwise unbeaten Packers. Of the 54.9 million homes in the United States then, 49.8 million had television sets, and nearly 12 million of them had been tuned to that Packers-Lions game, a record number for a regular season contest. The overall viewing audience for pro football had grown every year since 1956, with the exception of 1960. The ratings had gone up 10% in 1962 alone, a rise that made pro football attractively cost-effective for advertisers, according to Philip Morris Incorporated, one of its major sponsors. Using a formula that took into account the expense of a minute of advertising and the number of homes reached, Philip Morris determined that its advertising on an NFL game cost $4.56 to reach a single home, compared with $5.45 for college football. To reach adult males, advertising an NFL game was even more cost-effective than sponsoring the average primetime show, $4.21 to $6.33. Efficient advertising made the NFL more alluring to sponsors, which made it possible for Roselle to get more money from the networks and put more into the pockets of his owners. The commissioner's other mission was to make the league seem endlessly exciting, and he believed that this also could be accomplished as much off the field as on, by accommodating and ingratiating the television and print media, encouraging them to promote the new professional ideology. There would be a seamless web between playing the game and selling the game, conjoining life and art. Publicity efforts were coordinated by the league office. There were standard rules for press releases, statistics, press conferences. Storylines were conceived in New York and pushed around the country. To the extent that Lombardi had become the symbol of modern pro football, Roselle hoped to use him in that effort. This was one of many instances during the 1960s when others would try to enlist Lombardi in some larger cause, financial, cultural, or ideological. And though he usually obliged them, it was rarely a perfect match. At times, Lombardi was seen as a remnant from the old school, but he could no more be assigned to the past than considered a product of Roselle's new publicity machine. He was a transitional figure between old and new, but more than that, he was singular, with his own distinct philosophy and mythology. Roselle had not yet turned the championship game into a week-long extravaganza, but he had wished that Lombardi would put more into the selling of the 1962 title match than he did. The Packers practiced in Green Bay until noon Friday, then flew to New York and rode the bus into Midtown to their quarters at the Hotel Manhattan. Vince had made plans to take the family across the river that night to visit his parents in Englewood. He'd prepared his team for Sunday, even installed a surprise passing attack if conditions were suitable, and his pregame duties were mostly done, or so he thought. New York City newspapers were not publishing again, the second time in 4 years they'd been silenced by labor strikes while the NFL championship game was in town. Lombardi assumed that he wouldn't have to do much with the depleted press corps until Sunday. But shortly before 5 o'clock, he received a call from Jim Kensel, Roselle's chief publicist, who said the league had set up a big press conference at another hotel. It was about to start, but everyone was waiting for the Time cover boy to appear. Lombardi started arguing with Kensel. He said no one had told him about the press conference and that he couldn't attend because his parents were expecting him. Roselle took the phone from his aide. Lombardi was still angry, but he would not openly defy the league. After a short discussion, the commissioner hung up and said, "He's on his way." Whether Lombardi served any use was another matter. He uttered a string of yeps and nopes, disparaged a few questions, and left with his image as a temperamental grouch intact with some reporters. Lombardi considered himself a city man. There were times during the off-season when he would escape from Green Bay just to take a room at the Waldorf and sit surrounded by the city. He would go to Tutt Shores, where the proprietor greeted him as a beloved crumbum. Then over to Mike Minucci's, with his friends Eddie Breslin, William O'Hara, and Jim Lawler, and his little brother Joe, and a group of writers. Jerry Eisenberg of the Newark Star-Ledger described Lombardi as never happier than in that setting, standing amid his friends, first among equals, not emperor, as he was in Green Bay. Stationed so that he could see everyone in the place, unloosened by a few scotch and waters, talking about Fordham or his favorite singer or place on the road. At times like this, his laughter would fill the room, and everybody would smile no matter where you were in the room. Yet nothing could make him laugh or relax now. By Saturday, he seemed agitated to a state of exhaustion. Red Blake, who sat at his table for dinner that night at the Metropolitan Club, was struck by Lombardi's anxiety. Lombardi talked about how difficult the game would be, and how beat up his team was, and how the stress of success was starting to eat at him and drive him harder than ever. This was not about television revenues, magazine covers, publicity plans, sexy new ways of selling the game on Madison Avenue. It was about overcoming fate and temptation and paying the price and becoming immortal. "We're going to win," he finally blurted out, and then abruptly departed. He and Marie had left their daughter back at the hotel with the usual instructions. She was not to open the door for anyone except the waiter delivering dinner, and she was not to leave the suite for any reason. When she was done, she should place the tray in the hall and lock the door and go to bed. This was fine with Susan. She could eat in private and not have to worry about performing in front of her parents' friends. As soon as they left to meet Colonel Blake's dinner party, she put on a bathrobe, turned on the television, picked up the phone, and ordered room service. When the knock at the door came, she hurried to her suitcase and threw on a dress, a bright red one that her mother and Aunt Marge had helped her pick out that day, then let the waiter in and watched him set up her food. After eating, she did as her father said, and set the tray outside. Slam, click. The heavy hotel door closed, and there she stood, alone in the hall, without a key, locked out. Wearing only a little red dress, no stockings, no shoes, stuck on the top floor of a big hotel. What now? She had to make her way down to the lobby for a new key, but she was at the age where the last thing she wanted was to be noticed, and she was too embarrassed to get in the elevator in her bare feet. So she took the stairs. "I went down flight after flight. I was crying. I was in a panic," she said later. "I finally got out of the stairwell at an exit on the mezzanine level, and all I could do was look down, and there was this huge crowd of people in the lobby, and I hoped I would see somebody I knew. What were my chances?" In the swirling sea of faces, she spotted her brother. He was talking to Paul Hornung. She started waving and shouting his name, "Vincent! Vincent!" He looked up right at her, then turned his gaze. It appeared that he didn't want to acknowledge her. He was a college man, hanging out with the golden boy, the coolest guy in the world. This was humiliating. Susan kept yelling and waving until finally Vincent relented and walked up to the mezzanine and asked, "What's your problem?" She tried to explain. "He was mad at me because I was always a little rat, but he goes down and gets me a key. I think he's going to take me back up. But he pushes the button, the elevator opens, he hands me the key and says, 'Go back to your room.' And I'm standing there in the elevator with these people, and no shoes, and the red dress, and all the way up I'm saying to myself, 'Someday I'm going to kill him.' I get back into the room and get in my bed, and I'm a wreck. My parents finally come in. They always come in to kiss me goodnight. And my dad looked at me and knew that something was wrong. I started to cry and told him what happened, and he thought it was funny. And I said, 'I don't think this is very funny, Daddy. I was stuck, and I was trying to do what you told me to do.' He was laughing because, knowing me, he thought that would be par for the course, that I'd lock myself out like that and walk down 26 flights of stairs. I thought he was going to get mad at me, and he just laughed and laughed. Perhaps, if only for those few moments, his daughter's human foibles had settled the churning in Vince Lombardi's gut and provided a welcome relief from his life's burden of needing to be perfect and to win and win and win. By God, it was thrilling to be part of this, even if the coach made the job uncomfortable at times. The Milwaukee Sentinel's Bud Lee noted to himself as he looked around the bus carrying the proud Packers from the Hotel Manhattan up to Yankee Stadium that Sunday morning. Before Lombardi came to Green Bay, covering the football team never amounted to a hill of beans. Now the talent and sense of purpose the players exuded made Lee feel as though he were part of Patton's Third Army moving across Europe. Tex Moll had the same sensation. He was almost one of the boys now. "He loved the Packers, and we liked him because he knew something about football," Hornung said later of the Sports Illustrated writer. "He was always with us. We'd go out with him, get him smashed." The team had seemed sleepy during the final few games of the season, but their last few practices had grown more intense day by day, and now, on the ride to the showdown in the Bronx, Moll sensed that the Packers were imbued with a furious professional determination to prove that the licking they had given the Giants a year ago was no fluke. Lombardi was in his pre-game trance, saying nothing, looking straight ahead. Phil Bengston sat in the next row, reviewing his plans for containing Yelberton Abraham Tittle, the bald poet who played quarterback for the Giants and had ripened wondrously in his old age, throwing for 3,224 yards and 33 touchdowns in his 13th professional season. Bengston had watched the film so much he thought he had Yat figured out. Likes to throw on first down on the first series. If he calls a running play and it goes 6 yards or more, he'll come right back with it. If the last running play doesn't work, he'll throw twice. If it's long, it's to Del Schaffner. Short, to Frank Gifford or Joe Walton. Red Cochran, the offensive assistant, was heartened by what he saw out the window. Bitterly cold winds whipping paper trash through the city streets. In his hotel room late the night before, he'd listened to gale-force winds whistle through the Midtown skyscraper canyon and said softly, "Blow, winds, blow. The worse it is, the better for us." The Giants were a passing team. The Packers had Taylor and Hornung. Cochran liked their chances. Jesse Whittington, the defensive back, looked over at Moll and said, "It's cold as hell right now, but my hands are sweating." When the bus stopped and the players lumbered out, Jerry Kramer felt overwhelmed as he walked into Yankee Stadium to defend the championship. "It was a huge thrill just to be there," he said later. "The house that Ruth built, all the legends of the place. Playing against Cat Cabbage and Robustelli and Huff. I'm going, 'Legends, what are you doing going out there against those guys?'" Replacing one legend with another is what he and his Packers were doing. That's what the old man said. Back in Green Bay earlier that week, Lombardi had installed a sign above the locker room door. "Home of the Green Bay Packers, the Yankees of football." But were the Yankees this beat up? The Horn sat at his cubicle, dragging on a Marlboro, his shoulders sore, his knee still tender. He was determined to run and pass and block, just couldn't kick. Jim Ringo was concerned about his right arm. A nerve problem made it feel numb, hard to snap the ball. He didn't want to hurt the team. Should he play? Lombardi came by and said, "We've come this far, Jim, you have to play." And that settled that. Ron Kramer, the big oof, as Vikings coach Norm Van Brocklin called him, was getting taped up again. It took the trainer 20 minutes. White tape around the ankles, elastic around both knees, elastic around the back. A tight end mummy, wrapped from head to ribs. And Jimmy Taylor was looking gaunt. It was a mystery then what was draining him of 15 pounds in a few weeks. It would not be until many days later that doctors realized he had hepatitis. Taylor was wrapped and ready to go. Red, white, and blue bunting ringed the second deck of the stadium, filled to capacity with 64,892 frigid, breath-blowing fans, most of them rooting for giant revenge. O-K-Y-A, make Green Bay pay, read one bedsheet banner. Inside Madison Square Garden earlier that week, New Yorkers at basketball and hockey games had been chanting, "Beat Green Bay! Beat Green Bay!" And the call was picked up again now. News flashes on the transistor radios announced bumper-to-bumper traffic on the Jersey Turnpike, a mass of steel and humanity inching in the other direction toward Philadelphia, beyond the blackout zone, where people could watch the game on television. Others mobbed a few enterprising motels in Westchester County that had erected tall antennas to bring in the game from a station in Hartford. NBC had the broadcast rights for the championship and fielded a bipartisan announcing team of Ray Scott and Chris Schenkel for the play-by-play. But CBS, which broadcast the Giants during the year, held jealously to its booth, forcing Scott and Schenkel to work in an open photography platform down the right field line. Sports writers filed into the press box. Red Smith gazed around the stadium to conjure the images that might evoke the scene. When the teams came out for warm-ups, it was clear that this game would be decided by the basic elements. Earth and air, each in harshest form. Hornung ran a practice sprint and pronounced the field atrocious. It was hard, frozen in large swatches, with holes and ruts everywhere. "Better suited to ice hockey than football," wrote Moore. "When you fell," Ron Kramer noticed, "there were sharp pieces of dirt that cut like glass." Vincent, the college fullback, examined the field with his sidelines pass and thought it would be like playing in a parking lot. Bart Starr likened it to a slag pile. The Packers and Giants both came out in cleatless, ripple-soled football shoes, not unlike the ones Lombardi always wore at games, though his had blinding white laces. Frank Gifford alone chose sneakers. The wind was as unforgiving as the field. During warm-ups, Tittle threw one pass that was pushed to the ground after 5 yards, and another that soared and flailed up and away toward the first row of stands. "We just lost our passing game," an assistant lamented to Allie Sherman, the Giants' head coach. Red Smith devoted much of his column to meteorology. "Polar gales clawed top seed off the barren playground and whipped it into whirlwinds about the great concrete chasm of Yankee Stadium," he wrote. "The winds snatched up tattered newspapers, more newspapers than people can find in all New York these days, and flung the shreds aloft, where they danced and swirled in a Schubert blizzard." Once, when all the Packers arose from their wooden bench, it was blown over and onto the field. The temperature at game time was 18 degrees and dropping. This was before the era of wind chill factors, but the winds were 25 to 40 miles per hour, and the athletes remembered it as the single coldest game they'd ever played in. Colder even, many Packers insisted, than a more famous game 5 years later in sub-zero Green Bay. So cold that Lombardi gave up his lucky camel's hair coat for a thick-lined winter parka. Some of the fiercest scrums were around the heating drums on the sidelines. "There'd be flames shooting out, and we'd all be fighting to get closest to them," said Gary Knafel. Lombardi had invited Tom Brown, a talented athlete from Maryland, whom he'd just selected in the second round of the college draft, to join the Packers on the sidelines for the game. An unwise invitation, it turned out. As Brown shivered and looked around at the frigid and foreboding scene, he decided then and there to skip football and sign a contract to play baseball, the summer game, for the Washington Senators. Up in the auxiliary press box, an uncovered ledge on the second deck, Red Cochrane lost control of his frosted writing hand and was unable to chart the game. Ray Scott, in his makeshift broadcast booth nearby, with his spotting boards resting on his quaking knees, found his face stiffening minute by minute. "We ended up talking like this," he said later. "For years afterward, people accused me of being drunk." He was warmed by a few swigs of brandy from fellow announcer Bud Palmer's flask. But his paper cup of coffee froze when he poured in the liquor. There were 8 extra cameras at the game that day, filming not for television, but for the league to use in publicity game films. The contract for the job had been won by Blair Motion Pictures Incorporated, a small outfit in suburban Philadelphia owned by Ed Sable, who'd never before shot a professional game. When Sable got the job, he called his son Steve, who was then in college, and said, "I just bought the film rights, and I can see from your grades that all you've been doing is going to movies and playing football, and that makes you uniquely qualified for this job." Steve signed on as assistant producer, launching a family partnership that would later become known as NFL Films, an enterprise that more than any other would be responsible for creating the films and television shows that shaped the new mythology of professional football for the rest of the century. Ed Sable's start was inauspicious enough. He was so nervous before the game that he spent most of the next 2 hours in the restroom. Willie Wood kicked off for the Packers. He had the strongest leg, and Lombardi liked to have him back there as a sure-tackling last resort in case the returner broke clear. Wood placed the ball on a tee, and it blew off twice. Finally, he called a teammate over to hold the ball, and the game began. The Packers realized immediately that Tittle would keep passing despite the conditions, but he could only pass short. The long ball, his specialty, would dip and float aimlessly in the wind. He ended up throwing 41 passes, but none near the end zone. Lombardi scrapped his surprise aerial attack plan and put the game in the hands of Taylor and Hornung and his defense, led by Ray Nitschke, who recovered 2 fumbles, forced an interception with a blitz on Tittle, and would have had an interception of his own if his hands hadn't been so cold. Taylor gained 85 yards running the ball 31 times, almost every effort ending with a smack and thud and sprawling legs, 3 giants piling on. Sam Huff, the aggressive middle linebacker, occasionally giving Taylor an extra push into the icy turf or knee in the groin and telling Taylor that he stunk. "Did everything I could to that son of a bitch," Huff said later. And Taylor just looked at him and spit and said, "That's your best shot?" Taylor was never considered the brightest Packer. Dick Schaap had once written of him in a Saturday Evening Post article. "Jimmy Taylor, the great fullback of the Green Bay Packers, spent 4 years in college and emerged unscarred by education. And some of his teammates found him prickly off the field. But when it counted, in games like this, they were all thankful that he was on their team." It's part of football tradition that gridiron violence in the retelling takes on the form of comedy more often than of tragedy. And so it was with the defining story of that game, apocryphal or not, when Taylor groaned at the bottom of a pile and saw an exposed calf and bit it, and giant tackle Dick Modzelewski screamed, "Ow!" and Taylor looked up and said, "Sorry, Mo, I thought you were Sam." But it wasn't funny then. In the first quarter, Taylor was smacked in the helmet by Huff and cut his elbow and bit his tongue and was swallowing blood for the rest of the half. Dr. Eugene Brusky sewed him up at the break. His teammates could hear his moans of pain, stitch by stitch, as they sat in the locker room, silent and freezing, rubbing their bodies trying to get warm before heading out for the second half. He wondered if he'd be ready to go in the second half and be the football player he was in the first half, recalled Nitschke. Taylor did play, and he played just as hard, pushed on by Lombardi. He later explained his gutty performance by saying, "You never know until you are faced with it how much pain you can endure, how much effort you have left, and then the coach steps in and pushes you even beyond that point." He never held it against Lombardi, though. The push made the difference. Before a game, at halftime, and after a game, his players thought of Lombardi as a football genius. He always seemed able to anticipate what the other team was going to do. Although his game plan seemed simple, it was because of the dozens of plays that he'd eliminated, following Blake's dictum of discarding the immaterial, to get to the 15 or 20 that he was certain would work. But once the game started, the joke on the team was that Lombardi was the most useless guy on the sideline. Starr called the plays for the offense. Bengston called them for the defense. Lombardi never wore a headset. Red Cochran, the offensive coach in the press box, was afraid to call down to Lombardi for fear he would snap at him on the phone. "All Lombardi would do," said Gary Knafel, "was stand there and holler." Hornung thought his coach wasn't worth a crap during the game. He was an observer, a kibitzer. All you'd hear is, "What the hell's going on out there?" He was always on the go, striding up and down the sideline, watching the down markers, yapping away at the officials, correcting every call. The game itself was the superficial part of coaching for Lombardi. He'd already done his work getting his team prepared. The title game in New York drew on all the lessons he'd learned from the Jesuits and Colonel Blake. Simplicity, subsuming individual desire for the needs of the group. Second effort, enduring pain as a means to an end, paying the price. The Giants played ferociously, and the Packers held on with their will. Ringo playing through the numbness in his arm. Whittington with his rib cage bruised in the first quarter. Jordan hobbling on a sprained ankle. Taylor bleeding. They lost Willie Wood in the third quarter when he was ejected for bumping a referee. Unintentionally, the game films indicate. While protesting a pass interference call. Hornung, his knee banged again, limped from the lineup soon thereafter. Their kicking situation was a mess. Boyd Dowler couldn't punt, so Lombardi told Max McGee to return to his old job. "Jesus Christ, thanks a lot, coach," he muttered to himself. The winds made punting a horrible chore, as McGee later described his predicament. "You either had to lay the ball on your foot or throw it hard at your foot. If you dropped it to your foot like you normally did, the wind would blow it off path." He never had a punt blocked in his life until the third quarter of that game. The Packers were ahead 10-0 when McGee stood at his end zone and took the snap. Usually he would look to see if someone was coming, but this time he stared down at his foot as he threw the ball at his shoe and began his kicking motion. And there was Eric Barnes, the swift Giants' defensive back, on top of him. Thump! And the ball was rolling on the hard parking lot of a playing field toward the end zone, and Jim Collier was falling on it for a touchdown. It was the lone New York score. Less than the output of Green Bay's unorthodox scoring machine, Jerry Kramer, the place-kicking right guard. Since Hornung's bad knee forced him to stop kicking after the fifth game of the year, Kramer had substituted for him with equal parts efficiency and good humor. He'd missed only one extra point and two field goals during the last 9 games of the season, though every kick was an adventure. He was a lock-legged, straight-ahead kicker, as they all were in that era, but Kramer's signature was that he had no follow-through with his right leg. His teammates did a locker room routine. "Sports quiz. Who's this? Boink." That was the description of Kramer's kick. Boink. He boinked 3 field goals and 1 extra point against the Giants. "I was a little nervous about kicking in Yankee Stadium," Kramer said later. "What you do when kicking is keep your head down. The first one, when I looked up, It looked like the ball was outside the goalposts, yet the official was going like this, good, and I was saying, what the, what did? And Bart Starr, the holder, said, shut up and get off the field. The last boink came from 30 yards out with less than 2 minutes left.